Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and I'm really pleased to welcome back to the microphones Patricia McConnell. She is back with us to talk about methods of dog training. She's a certified applied animal behaviorist, an international speaker, and author. And we're going to talk with her about whether traditional training or maybe something called behavior management is the way to go. And, of course, we'll take your animal behavior comments and questions as we move along. She and I work together. What was it, Patricia? Welcome, by the way. 14 years were we together for...
Yeah, for Calling All Pets. That's right. And then you're still stuck with me because I wander in like a puppy in the rain saying, Larry, could I come?
Well, it's always great to have you here. And as you listen to Patricia talk, I hope you'll join in. How has your dog responded to behavior training, maybe? Join the conversation. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Patricia, before we talk about different training methods, how's your dog Maggie doing?
Oh, you're so sweet to ask. For those of you who are wondering why you asked me, Maggie tried her best to die. It turns out that eating the cork to a wine bottle is the perfect way to stop up one's digestive system. It ended up landing right below the pyloric valve at the top of her small intestines. Her stomach filled with 1.1 liters of fluid, and she began bloating, so she went into torsion, which is fatal.
Mm.
I woke up in the morning, and this is just a reminder to everybody. If your dog starts bloating and look like they have a watermelon in their belly, you need to get to the emergency clinic ASAP. And I was so lucky she did not die in the middle of the night. Just because I'm lucky, I woke up, I saw her. I could tell across the room. I ran to Veterinary Emergency Service in Middleton, who saved her life. It took them a day to figure out that she had a wine cork, of all things, stopping her up. So she had surgery. They opened up her intestines. She's doing great. It was pretty dodgy. She actually had to go back to the emergency room. It was awful. It was horrible. And she's fine. And she's like, I'm totally fine. Why did you pull me from the trial this weekend? I could have done it. But Tricia says, no, not yet. We need to get you back in condition. So she's 9.5 and thinks she's 3. And I'm now at least 10 years older than I was.
Oh man.
What a nightmare.
Well, let's zero in on training methods for what's behavior management, or how do you see that?
Yeah, I'm so glad we're talking about this because it's something that professional trainers talk about a lot. You know, animal behaviors and trainers often suggest just management versus training. I'm not saying training's not great. I'm a professional animal trainer, right? I love training. I love learning. I love all the science behind it. However, there are lots of times when professionals make a choice themselves with their dogs and advocate to people that maybe the particular issue that's bothering you is better managed than trained. And I'll give you an example with actually Maggie.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Maggie, I have two border collies. Maggie is the barker. Skip has barked once in his entire life, and he said, woof. Actually, it was twice. Woof. That's it. So Maggie can be barking her head off when somebody pulls up into the driveway, which I like. I like knowing, you know.
Sure.
I like that kind of like, hey, yo.
You're out in the country.
You're out in the middle of nowhere. Somebody pulls up. I like knowing that. But I don't like her continuing to bark and bark and bark and bark. Bark while I go outside to get the UPS package or whatever, right? So I could train her to do all kinds of things. I could train her to stop barking. I could train her to sit and stay. I could train her to go to a little pad. Or I could easily train her just run in another room into my study and go in the crate, or just go into the study and I'll just shut the door. So there was a little training there, but basically I'm managing it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I want to talk about it, Larry, is because so many clients resist it. And other, my colleagues and I have talked about it and talked about it and talked about it. Well, that is the question. So here's our hypothesis, is that what owners want to do is for their dog to change their behavior, right? And so the way you do that is training. Training can be easy depending on the context and the issue. Training can take a lot of time and a lot of work and a certain amount of skill sometimes. Management doesn't ask the dog to do something different. It asks the owner to do something different. And and we think, and again, we're just hypothesizing, we think either that that's part of it, right? Well, here's what I think. I think it's part of it. I think it's like, I want my dog's behavior to change. I want my dog to stop barking when, you know, the delivery person is in the driveway. I want my dog to change their behavior. I don't want to change my behavior. But I also think, Larry, people often feel like they've failed, like they're not good enough, like they should be able to train it, right? If they were a good enough owner, a smart enough person, they could train it, when all they have to do is change their own behavior the tiniest little bit, and they can manage their way out of it. So training and management, hand in hand, best possible practice.
So when the UPS person comes and the dog barks, you send the dog to...
I just say, Maggie, go to the study. And because I've rewarded her, so there is some training, right?
Yeah.
I rewarded her for going into the study. So I say, go in your crate. So she runs into the study and goes in her crate. And I say, good girl. And maybe I'll give her a treat. Maybe I won't, because it's trained now. It's, you know, she's got it, right? I need to reinforce it variably. So I'll just say, what a good girl, and shut the door. And then we're done, right?
So yeah. Are there kinds of problems that respond better to behavior training than others?
Or? Yeah, that's a really good question. The things that management is sort of best for is context in which a dog is highly motivated to do X, right? And, you know, it's some natural dog behavior, barking, you know, at an intruder, right? Say, for example, you have a dog who has, you have a fenced backyard. Right. And the dog fence fights with another dog and barks and raises a ruckus at the dog who lives next door. Right.
Yeah.
You know, so they're all kind of, there's certainly I would advise training. You need to teach your dog to come when called so you can just call it in a way, you know, but you could also manage it by putting up a screen and, you know, in between the fences. And sometimes that's easier than actually trying to train it. So, yeah, it depends. I can't answer your question like I want to because it depends so much on the dog and where you are as a person and how busy you are, how much you love training. You know, it's one of those, it's my favorite answer to everything, Larry, which is it depends.
Right. Well, here's a little story. I often get up in the middle of the night, say around midnight, to run to the bathroom.
No, I can't imagine what that's like.
And the cat, one of my cats, Coco, who sleeps right next to me, gets up and he wants to go to the bathroom with me because he wants a drink from the sink.
Ah, okay.
And the lights aren't on. And the other morning, I accidentally kicked him.
Happens.
And I said, oh, I'm sorry, Coco. I apologized. Coco. And I know, because I'm just looking at your blog, that this whole business about apologizing to your dog or your cat, lots of people apologize to their pets.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
I could see that from your
No kidding.
Blog.
We just about all do, don't we? Or at least should, I would argue.
Do they get it, though?
Oh, that is the question, and there's no answer in my recent blog posts about it. But here's some speculation. It's, you know, and we had a great conversation on the blog and on Facebook about this. So first of all, if that happens all the time to all of us, right? We do something, we step on a dog's paw, we open the door too fast, and it sort of runs into your dog, and, you know, and the human response, human response, to say, oh, I'm so sorry. And so what do we know about how they respond to it? So one way to look at it is look at it evolutionarily. Look at wild canids, first of all. You know, look at their closest relatives. And so what we know about them doesn't answer the question, but it sheds some good light on it.
Okay.
So first of all, we know, for example, dogs come from species that are closely related to species like wolves that are uber social. Hypersocial, super social, rare in the animal world, actually. You know, very few mammals are as social as dogs are and as people are. We're just super social. We'll give up our own reproduction to help a relative, right, to sort of raise relatives' babies. And if you look at dogs or wolves, you often see what's called appeasement behavior. And in some senses, that's related to sort of a kind of a social hierarchy. It's like, yeah, you know, I don't want to upset you. And we do it too. You know,
sure,
in the restaurant, you ask for sweet potato fries instead of regular fries. And the waitress is harassed and busy. And she looks at you and you cock your head in that little appeasing way and say like, oh, I'm so sorry. I know you're really busy, but blah, blah, blah. Right? We all do it, right?
Yeah.
So sometimes appeasement behavior is about not upsetting the forces of power. But sometimes appeasement behavior in many species, social species, primates, dogs, appears to be a kind of a, I don't know if I can say I'm sorry. You know, we don't know. Is it an apology? Mm-hmm. But it's something like a dog will like two dogs are fighting for, or play fighting, for example. They're playing, and then all of a sudden somebody like, wow, you hurt me. You know, you played too hard. And the other dog will go up and lick its face. Is that an apology?
Yeah.
It could be. And so the best speculation, I think, is in a super social species. And cats, by the way, do not have the same kind of social hierarchy as dogs. But there still can be really social. People misunderstand.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's why the cat sleeps in bed with you. It's not just because it's warm, right? So, I mean, a lot of cats are super bonded to their people. So it makes sense in species that are living together to have some kind of signal that says, I didn't mean that, right? You know? And so I think it's good that we apologize to dogs. From a trainer's perspective, a behaviorist perspective, the best thing to do is just be consistent, you know, is to say the same thing. It's like, you know, and I just say, I'm sorry. You know, and I just did it yesterday. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, Skippy. I didn't mean to shut the door on your head. And he didn't understand the part where I said, but if you hadn't barreled in through it in order to go work sheep, it wouldn't have happened. But I didn't say that part.
Well, I was amazed. And we should mention your whole site there. Talk about that for a minute.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. Well, I have a website. Just go to my name, patriciamcconnell.com. And I think the part that I'm proudest of is the Learning Center, which is a place you can dive into. Tons of free advice, videos, articles, links to blogs where I've talked about different issues from, you know, behavioral problems to the relationship between, you know, people and other animals, for example. But you can also go to my blog, which I write every other week, just about always. And sometimes, like yesterday's, my day didn't go yesterday like I thought it was going to, Larry. I know that's never happened to you. But so I wrote a much shorter version than I normally do. But
it was great.
Yeah, thanks. It was short, but I appreciate that. Anyway, it's a wonderful village. And then I'm on Facebook. PatriciaMcConnell.com. Just check it out. Thanks.
Check it out.
Thank
indeed.
You.
Patricia McConnell, our guest. Today, Trina LaSusa is our engineer, by the way, and Jill Nadeau is our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest today as we talk about pet behavior. Behavior management is something we've been dealing with a little bit with Patricia McConnell, certified applied animal behaviorist, international speaker, and author of several guides and books on training behavior problems. It's great to have her back. And certainly if you have a question, you can join the number to call 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Kathy in Hayward, we'll give you a chance. Thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
I just was wondering if there's anything to calm a terrier down.
I'm sorry. If I'd been drinking tea, I would have spit it out. That was, I laugh with sympathy, but with a realistic understanding. But
okay.
Do me this favor. Tell me specific context in which that behavior is a problem.
He seems to be a little wild, you know, high strung. They put him on gabapentin because he has phantom seizures.
Oh.
There's nothing. But now he just seems to get amped up.
About anything?
Well, we live in the woods, so when the neighbors come up, he barks. Right now we have a cabin that's doing construction, so he's been barking all day. And, you know, we try to, you know, get him to the crate, treat him, but it's not really helping.
So, oh, yeah, okay, I sympathize with this. And construction next door and a reactive terrier is like, you know.
Perfect storm.
Yeah, no kidding. Larry, do you have an extra guest room? Could we get this poor woman out of this situation? Oh, man. So I guess what I would do is I would do some training, first of all, that will help with the management. So you're really, kudos for you for trying to manage it, but by putting them in a crate, you know, sort of away from the windows. So the first thing I do in regard to the training is I would start doing the training when it's night, when there's nobody there, when there's no disruption, right? And start training him to go into the crate or into the room with a crate, which I assume is away from windows and as far away from the noise as you can get. Is that right?
Yes, and he's very smart. He's trained himself to go in the crate whenever he hears me use a pepper grinder. So he thinks we're having dinner, so he wants to be polite, and he goes in his crate.
Oh, good boy. So he's very smart. So you can actually use the pepper grinder. Use whatever you need, literally. Seriously. You can actually link the pepper grinder to a noise you make, you know, so you just say crate up and then do the pepper grinder, and then eventually he'll just go to crate up. Give him lots of rewards for going in there. Do lots of practice sessions when there's nobody out there. There's no reason for him to go in a crate. He goes in the crate, he gets a piece of chicken, he gets to come out again. Do that 3 times in a row, you know, twice in the evening, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So keep building on that. And then ask a member of your family to create a bit of a disturbance outside. Maybe they pull the car up, or maybe they just make some noises outside. So he has a reason, right, to go to the window and bark. And you go right to him. You show him the piece of chicken you are holding in your hand, this cooked rotisserie chicken you just bought. Rotisserie chicken, I just want to say, is a dog trainer's best friend, right? So you take that, and you lure him into the crate. You give him a couple of pieces, and then you just let him go. And you've asked your friend to stop making the noise. So there's no reason to bark anymore. So that's your sort of transition point. See that? And then you gradually, over a period of weeks, sort of work your way up to asking him to go in when there's more and more disruption. And I would, tomorrow when there's disruption and you obviously haven't been able to work your way up step by step, just go to him, put him on a leash. You can show him the chicken. He'll probably ignore it completely. Take him in, put him in the crate, give him maybe a Kong stuffed with frozen food or something that's not all frozen. So he's going to have something to do and, you know, chew on some food in there. Give him things to do, especially some kind of a food device, right, that he can't get all the food right away. And so I think you can make big strides on this, right? So this is the perfect example of sort of the combination of training and management. Does all that make sense?
Yes. He's developed a new thing where he's afraid that we're using appliances. So a little tiny vacuum, a screwdriver, and he's just worried about that.
So he barks or what?
Yeah, he'll actually like nip at us to stop us, or nip at the vacuum to get us to stop using it.
Okay, wow. That's, you know, and I'm curious about this because you mentioned these seizures. Some kind, you know, I'm not a veterinarian, I'm a behaviorist, right? My PhD is in zoology and behavior. But I know that there are some noises that can set off neurological disruptions, right?
Mm.
So it might be that he's classically conditioned to associate those things, or they really bother his brain in ways that that they wouldn't bother us. I'm working, Larry and caller. I forgot your name. I'm sorry.
Kathy,
thank you. I'm working on a post that will come out maybe a month from now about whether dogs can be on the spectrum or not. And one of the symptoms of that is like hypersensitive, hyperreactive to external stimuli, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for that, you have control over, right? So again, you might just put him away. You might classically condition it. I'm going to give you a piece of chicken. Then I'm going to turn on the, you know, the vacuum cleaner in another room. Then I'm going to turn it off, give you a piece of chicken. So start conditioning him to react differently to those noises.
Mm-hmm. There you go, Kathy. Good luck with that. Appreciate your call very much. Randy in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Randy.
Good morning. This may not be I'm betting this is something you know, even if it's not in your job description. But I don't own a dog myself. But whenever I go out to eat and get ribs, or when we cook ribs ourselves, I save the bones. And I've shared them with some neighbors, or sometimes just scattered them where dogs can find them. And then I've heard that when you cook the ribs, the bones tend to splinter,
yeah,
and they're dangerous.
That's right.
I wonder if you know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Good for you. That's a wonderful thing to bring up. Yes, cooking. Well, I'll first tell you a story after emphasizing that cooked bones are much more likely to splinter than uncooked bones, and can indeed lodge in dogs' intestines. And having just had a dog who had intestinal surgery, you know, and just writing a check for $8,000, I just want you to know you definitely want to avoid that. But So that's really important. But the quick story is that I was in Jamaica a million years ago and staying at this wonderful house. We just rented a little house right in this community. It wasn't a touristy area at all. And this wonderful woman who lived next door came in and cooked us this wonderful, great dinner. Fresh fish one night, roast chicken the next night. And then she took the cooked chicken bones and put it out for the neighbor dogs. And me and several other Americans were like, oh, you can't do that. That's dangerous. And, you know, these are street dogs, right?
Mm-hmm.
These are half-starving street dogs. And she just burst out laughing. It's like, you foolish Americans. So is it always going to hurt a dog? No, of course not. But it does increase the probability that a bone shard could get stuck.
Yeah.
Damage the stomach lining, get stuck in the intestines, do a lot of damage. And, you know, also, I also learned the hard way, there are even raw bones. I used to give one of my border collies, Willie, the big, long bone, femur bone of a beef, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was just the long bone. The joints were cut off. Well, that bone turns out to be so hard that he broke a tooth on it and needed a root canal. So there's a, you know, just picture the dollar bills flying away, guys. So all raw bones are not safer. And, of course, there's controversy about raw versus not raw. But cooked bones are definitely not something I would ever give a dog and that I think is wise for you not to either.
There you go, Randy. Thank you so much for calling. By the way, we have some open lines to get you on pretty quickly. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Talking about dogs' behavior, maybe yours. If you have a question, join in. Jeff and Racine will give you a chance. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Patricia. Hey, we, my wife and I pretty much adopted a French bulldog. And he was about 6 months old when we got him. And unfortunately, he pretty much spent his whole life in a crate. So when we got him, he wasn't housebroken. He didn't even know how to go for a walk.
Aww.
But what has happened, he's turned into a perfect boy. He's a big boy, 35-pounder, but he has a heart of gold. But he has one behavior that we just can't seem to get rid of. And it's he just wants to eat feces.
Oh, gotcha.
And we don't let him eat his own because we pick it all up right away. But, you know, there's a lot of unresponsible dog owners in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So we're always having that battle. But the biggest battle was is we wanted to take him to, like, doggy daycare so my wife and I could have some time. And unfortunately, all he wants to do is eat everybody else's at the doggy daycare. So that turned out to be a total disaster because he was sick for 3 days after that.
No, dear.
Oh, yeah. But how do I? We are just, you know, we've heard the give him pineapple. It'll make it taste. Well, he doesn't get to eat his own because we don't let him.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So much for that idea, right? You know, this coprophagia is. It's not, the vets always tell us, it's not a medical problem. You know, unless there's a big worm load and you have concerns about dogs getting worms. And by the way, just parenthetically, I'll tell you, there's actually a hypothesis that part of the reason why dogs are coprophagic is because it turns out if you eat feces within a day or two of it being deposited, mm-hmm. there is less chance of the worms in there, if there are worm eggs in there, to actually functionally get into the dog, the eater dog's body and cause problems. Who knew that? I mean, who knew that? Now, do dogs know? It's totally counterintuitive. And who know? You know, do dogs know that? Of course not. Of course they do. They do not know that. But maybe there was some evolutionary pressure. I think that's an interesting speculation. I have to say that I think it's just as much about being a dog. You know, there's some dogs who have wonderful lives growing up who are coprophagic. The Navajo word, by the way, for dog, the Navajo language, it's a beautiful language. I lived on the reservation for a while. It's a beautiful descriptive language. And I have to modify the way I describe it, but the translation of the Navajo word for dog is eater of horse poop. That's what they call them because they love feces. I know, just dogs eat and they eat feces. Right now, my dogs are like going crazy over the rabbits in the yard, right? So this is the kind of thing that when you're managing it really well in terms of picking up your own dog's feces, good for you. We do the same thing. We live in the country and we still pick up their poop. And it's not good for the environment. So yay for you for doing that. The other management thought I had, how could there have been so much dog poop at the daycare that he was sick for 3 days? That there shouldn't
be
that much dog poop in the yard. That bothers me. So so that's something to sort of think about. You might want to check out some other daycare centers. So it really is a possibility. So those are some management issues. But this does require training because you have to walk in the neighborhood, right? And there's, as you say, there's dog poop where it shouldn't be. So what you want to train him to do is something called leave it. I mean, you can use whatever word you want, but basically it means leave it alone, right? Leave it alone and turn around and look at me. As I use that with Maggie, who is coprophagic. And so I'll say, Maggie, leave it. And what she's learned is that I have something better than the poop, right? So first I taught her leave it. And I can't go through the whole thing, but I can summarize it if we got time, Larry, for a little quickie. So the way I start teaching leave it is I'll have two different kinds of food, some kind of boring kibble, cereal, something not very attractive to a dog, but still food. And then I'll have chicken, right? Hot dogs, you know, something. I'm not crazy about hot dogs because they're not very healthy, but you know, a meat, right? They're carnivores. They're really omnivores, but they love meat. So you're going to have each of these foods in different hands, one in your right hand, one in your left hand. You're going to hold one hand behind your back. You're going to present the boring food in a closed fist. Let your dog sniff it. And they sniff it, and you say, leave it. And then you wait, but you wait watching like a hawk. This is where your observational skills are really important. You watch like a hawk. So they sniff, 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 sniff. And the second they withdraw their head, even 2 inches, they turn their head away an inch, they do something that tells you they're less interested in that than they were before, you say, good dog. And you whip the other hand in front and give them the piece of chicken, right? So they're like, oh, if I say leave it, or if I hear leave it and withdraw the tiniest little bit, then I get something even better. And so that's the easy part. The hard part is working your way up step by step by step to the actual reality of you're walking in the neighborhood and he sees it before you do, right? But that's the way you work your way up to that. And that's what I would do. And it's usually very effective. My guess is that because your poor little Frenchie had such a horrible beginning, that's sort of partly why he's so obsessed. But, you know, other dogs with great beginnings are too. So who knows why?
Yeah, who knows why. That's good advice. Jeff, thank you. Good luck. Appreciate the call. Heather in Madison, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So I have two dogs, and one's a Westie and one's a Westie Poodle mix. And my Westie is very reactive towards other dogs to the point where, like, he grabs a hold of his leash and is like, and then my other little dog starts barking at him, and it's just like a nightmare. It's just a scene, basically, when I'm walking down the street. And I started carrying treats and being like, look, and, you know, dropping them on the sidewalk if we see another dog, which is working more or less. But my big question is I like can't board my dogs because they hate other dogs. So I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Okay. So first of all, yay for you. I mean, you're doing some great stuff there. So carrying really great treats with you, saying, look, I talk about that kind of method in a booklet called Feisty Fido, which is about exactly that kind of dog. And basically, you know, you can either just teach them when they see another dog, you can say, look, which means turn your head and look at me and you'll get a treat. Or, you know, get down on the, you know, look at the chicken that you dropped on the ground. You can also teach a dog. It's very similar, but it has a slight variation to it. I think this is also very successful. You basically say, where's the dog? So you teach a dog, if you look at another dog, then you get a piece of whatever, you know, some great, great, great treat that they really love, dried liver or something, you know, or chicken or whatever. So that can be really helpful. So keep working on that. If your dog is over threshold, meaning that they see another dog, you drop chicken, and they ignore it, right? And they start barking and, you know, biting on their own leash, and they're just sort of lost. They're lost. You're not going to get through to them, right? You're just going to turn away and go the other way. And so one of the things to do is you might want to start keeping, you probably have done this already, just in your mind, you know what the threshold is. We can get within 40 feet of another dog, and once we're at 30 feet, he's lost it, right? He won't even take a piece of chicken. So pay a lot of attention to that threshold and start working on the edges of it. But whenever he's over threshold, you're just going to turn around and go the other way. So that's the training part, all right? That's the training part. And also some management, because you're going to turn and go the other way. Then in terms of a boarding, there should be places. I know there's one north of Madison that changed its name, and I can't remember it. But there. A good boarding kennel, in my opinion, and I have very strong feelings about this, and it means I'm going to make a lot of boarding kennel people mad. I'm sorry. But I personally would not put a dog in a kennel with sort of a line of kennels where dogs can, even if they can't see each other, can hear each other. And somebody walks in and everybody, bar, 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 bar. That's a really difficult, overstimulating situation for dogs to be in. I totally get why your dog can't be in that situation. You know, he might displace and turn around and go after your, you know, your little dog. So that's the last thing you want. I mean, you could always try boarding them separately. But I would call around. Where are you in Wisconsin, by the way?
Madison.
I'm Madison.
So that's good. So I would call around and just say, I have a super reactive dog. He can't be in a normal boarding kennel, which some dogs really are fine in, and love the play groups, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But he can't be in that situation. What could you do for me? You know, what kind of possibilities do you have? The other is to have a house sitter come in. If you need to leave and you can't take your dogs, then have a house sitter come in. And there are professional house sitters. And so, you know, you just go online and find some.
There are several in the Madison area.
There are several in the Madison area. And there are also good friends. They're, you know, they're retired people. They're young people who are looking for a way where they can sit and study. You know, our house sitter is at vet school, you know. And so she comes in the house and I totally trust her to take care of my dogs, right? Because also she's really good at behavior and management and training. And she does a lot of, you know, she has a nice, quiet place to be, and she does a lot of studying. So there are sitting resources out there, and they're not that much more expensive than kennels in some cases. So I would check that out.
Good luck, Heather. Thank you so much for calling. And let's go on to Karen in Delafield. Hi, Karen.
Oh, hi, Larry and Patricia. So I have had all kinds of dogs throughout my life. We're retired. And we have decided on dachshunds. Dachshunds are our best. They're portable. We love them. So we have a four-year-old, very laid-back female. And then we have a one-year-old piebald dachshund who has recently become aggressive when people come into our yard. And we have a lot of, we don't have close neighbors, but it's when UPS people or whatever. And what we've resorted to now is picking him up when we know someone is coming. But I just want to see what else can I do. He's sweet in every other way. He's fine at the dog park. He's never aggressive. But it's just when people come to our house, and especially especially men.
Hmm. Yeah, those men. just to make a comment about that, because it's so common, you know, and there's a lot of speculation about why that would be true. A lot of people, and I'm not saying you, Karen, at all, but a lot of people have, as clients of mine, have said, like, I know he was abused by men because he's afraid of unfamiliar men, but not women. And that's rarely the case, actually. You know, men can do, you know, they can get into a lot of trouble, but they're more likely, much more commonly, dogs behave differently. They react differently to men because of some physical features. Men have larger jaws, they're better to bite you with. They have beards sometimes. They often have on hats. They walk differently. I mean, there's tons mm-hmm. of research on how men and women walk differently, and people who trans from one to the other talk about how profoundly differently people react to them on a busy city street. So men walking down the street, people move away, right? Women walking down the street have to barrel their way through and basically get their shoulders bumped all the time. So men walk differently. They smell different. You know, how much is it testosterone? I don't know. So it's very, that's one that's very, very common. So this is a management and a training issue, I would basically say. Is, I presume your doxy, is it like in a front yard where people pull up?
We
is that
have
right?
3 acres, and they're free range dachshunds.
Yeah. And they stay around. Good. Wow.
They do. They don't go anywhere.
Well, do not let them read the chapter right. on typical dachshund behavior, because then they'd be off in the woods after, you know, rabbits.
No, they're really, really good.
Oh, what sweeties. Sweeties. So I would, given that all that is okay, and there's nothing wrong with picking him up, but I will tell you that very often picking up a small dog when an intruder, right, is coming into your yard doesn't make them feel better about the intruder. Sometimes it can make them more aggressive. When I'm up higher, you know, I'm stronger, I'm bigger, I'm taller. Or also, I'm trapped and now I'm scared. So it can sort of go either way. You know, we can't really ask them. But it often doesn't help things, and sometimes it can make it worse. Now, you've managed it to keep him from hurting somebody or scaring somebody, so that's all good. I would work on teaching him, when you know somebody's coming, I would put him in the house rather than let him loose. I think that's a much better strategy, because once you sort of grab them and pick them up, and often when that happens, you pick them up pretty fast. It's, you know, it's like, oh, yeah. Somebody's coming. You sort of have to grab at them. And that can be a little stressful, right? He's not afraid of you, but it's like, oh, something's wrong. You know, I just got lifted up into the air by a crane. You know, something, it must be dangerous. Something must be wrong. So I would try and work your way around that management-wise. But I would also have... And if you were my client, we would set up counter conditioning parties where you and I would gather together a group of 8 or 10 guys, right? 5 or 6, 3 or 4, whatever you could get, and you'd have a counter conditioning party. You'd promise pizza and beer at the end, or, you know, steak and wine, I don't care, whatever. Whatever's a good reinforcement. And you'd ask them to line up way back from the yard, and then one at a time, starting with the shortest guy, ending with the tallest guy, or the biggest guy, or the guy with the biggest beard, or whatever, whoever might be most intimidating if you met him in a back alley, mm-hmm. all right, you didn't know yeah. him. So start with the least intimidating guy, and he walks out of the property, and he has those magical pieces of chicken, or dried liver, or steak, or, you know, some venison, some kind of amazing, wonderful meat food that dogs love. And he just gets to the edge of the property. Your dog is on a leash, so you make sure he's not going to hurt anybody. You don't care if he's barking right now. And the guy throws treats way ahead of him, right to the dog. And so your little doxy is like, wait. And then gobbles up the treats, right? And then maybe he walks one more step forward and he throws more treats. And then he goes to the back of the line, and then the next guy comes. You do that over and over again. Then you put the dog in a crate. Reinforce the guys who are so good to help you. And so basically you're counter conditioning. You're using that Pavlovian conditioning, You know, bell means food, therefore I'll drool, right? That Pavlovian conditioning, man comes to the property, I get chicken, I love men. So that's what I would do if you were my client. So just be cautious. Don't go too far too fast. Whenever you think, should I do any more? Don't. Because usually the problem is that people go too far too fast and they push it too far and then they get in trouble.
There you go. Good luck, Karen. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Patricia McConnell, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your dog's behavior and maybe managing that behavior a little bit or doing a little training. Patricia McConnell, our guest, certified applied animal behaviorist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today. Really appreciate your calls and your emails. And before we get back to those, Patricia, the Animal Behavior Society is having a public day. And let's talk about what is the Animal Behavior Society and what's the event?
Yeah, thanks for asking. First of all, the Animal Behavior Society is the group of people like me who were trained, who basically their career is in studying animal behavior. Most of it is on wild animals. So a lot of the great specials you see on TV, you know, National Geographic and Nature, all those shows, very often you'll see the journalist or the narrator who's with an animal behaviorist who spent, you know, 20 years in the field studying polar bears or right whales or, you know, coyotes. This is the annual conference of the people who make a living basically studying animal behavior. But there's a group of us who do applied work. So we don't work with polar bears. We work with, you know, American Eskimo dogs. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's applying what we learned about behavior, not just to study it, but to solve problems related to it, usually with animals either in zoological parks or wildlife problems or, in a lot of cases, companion animals. So the conference is in different places, every year all over the world, right? This year it's in Costa Rica. It's going on right now. But my colleagues and I, years ago, who are in applied, decided we would create a day that's called the public day, where you don't have to be, you know, an academic, you don't have to be a member of a animal behavior society to learn about how science can inform and enhance your relationship with the animals that you live with. So the quote public day is this Saturday, this coming Saturday, July 26, 2022, and it's online, so you don't have to go to Costa Rica, although gosh, I wish I could.
Yeah.
It's online. You just go to the Animal Behavior Society, go to the conference program, and under the program and events, you'll see a thing that says Public Day. You don't need to register. It's completely free. It starts at 8 a.m. That's Eastern, though, so it starts early Saturday morning. The talks are relatively short. They're like 15, 20 minutes, and there's a great range of talks from really interesting perspectives. And basically, I should say that the topic is stress. General topic is stress. I have to tell you that I've been asked to talk about stress in animals in the last 2.5 years more than any other topic. Funny that would be true, right? I mean, there's so much stress in the world in our species right now. It's a really hot topic, and it's a really, really important topic. So there's talks about distress, which is the bad part of stress. Stress mm-hmm. can also be a really good thing. It depends on your perspective. There's some great speakers. One of my colleagues, Melissa McHugh McGrath, is going to give a great talk on a different perspective on stress and dog training. Anybody who loves companion animals, is interested in behavior and training, it's free. You could just jump online, listen when you want to, then go do something else. And there's a live panel from 3 to 4 Midwestern time, Central time, when all the speakers will get together and speak. So Animal Behavior Society, go to the program, go to the public day, and enjoy, enjoy, enjoy.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. And that's this Saturday.
That's this Saturday, yep. That's the 26th. No, that's today. Today is the 26th. What am I talking about? That is this Saturday, the 30th.
The 30th. There we go.
Thanks, Larry. I misspoke.
Oh, let's take another call. Stephen Stoughton has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I have a rescue Mastiff Hound mix.
Mm-hmm.
We've had him for about 6 months or so. Great dog.
Aww.
But he's managing us. He loves to scratch at the door, even though he's been outside, even though he's eaten. He just, you know, scratches at the door. So
he wants to go back out?
Yeah, well, he either wants to go back out, but sometimes he gets out, then he comes wants to come right back in.
And that is so common. And my guess about that is, yeah, he wants to go outside, but he wants you to go outside with him. It's like, let's all go outside. I don't want to be away from you. I love you. You're my family. I love you, but I want to go outside. Let's go outside. Come on. So they scratch, you let him out, and then they just turn around and go like, whoa, woof. And it's not let me in. It's like, come on out here. Come on, come on, come on. Do you know anything? You said he was a rescue. Do you know anything about his background? Was he housed outside? Did he grow up outside? What's the story?
Oh, really? Here? Yeah. Great. I believe, yeah. They were from a breeder in Texas is where they came up from. And, yeah, I believe they were outside. They were treated horribly bad, horribly bad.
Oh.
So, but, yeah, I believe they were outside because he has marks on his body from fly bites, you know.
Yeah. So even though he suffered a lot, that was familiar, right?
Yeah.
So that's what's familiar to him. You said you had him 6 months. How old is he now? Do you know? Guesses?
1 year.
Okay. So he was imprinted on being outside, right? At an early age. That's where he's probably most comfortable. So, yeah. So he's trying to tell you, please come outside with me. So a couple things I would do is see if you can spend more time outside with him, first of all. You know, it's ironic. I was just at a friend's outside of Cambridge who has a brilliant, gorgeous Sherman Shepherd who wants to lie outside right by the door in a fenced yard. You know, it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
But she just rather lie outside. And it's, you know, there are a lot of other dogs. It could be sort of chaotic in there. But also, I think she's a little bit of an introvert. Like, she loves social interactions, mm-hmm. but it tires her out. She just loves to lie by the door outside. So I think that's the main thing, is that he wants you to go out there with him because he's most comfortable there. So a couple things I do. Increase the amount of time you're outside with him. That would be a really good thing. When he scratches on the door, don't ever open the door, all right? You never open the door when he scratches on the door because you're just reinforcing it. And if you do it 1 out of 10 times, then he learns I have to do it at least 10 times, you know, before they'll open the door. So you just have to cut that out of your repertoire. So when he scratches on the door, I know some people would punish him. I wouldn't do it. I just call him over. What's his name?
His name is Yayo.
Yayo. I would just, hey, Yayo, hey, bud, come on over here. Come on, boy. And then I would give him some pets and just give, you know, pet his belly, let him sort of drape his body all over you like mastiffs love to do, right? Just sort of pet him, rub, give him a belly rub. And then you might be like, hey, bud, you want to go outside? And then go out together for a while.
Mm.
And I would try working on that. That's pretty minimalist, but I think given it's only been 6 months and given his background, that might be all you need. It might take 3, 4, 5 months, but that's what I try first, for sure.
That sounds great. Thank you very much, Steve, for calling. Pam emailed to say she's thinking of getting a companion for her adult cat and wondering the process you recommend to introduce the new cat or kitten. And if we've got about a minute and a half or so to do.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Okay. So there is a sort of standard protocol, which often works, but not always. Some cats really don't want another cat to come in the house, but the owner does, right? And I totally know what that feels like. So most important, do not force the cats together. Do not force the cats onto each other. What you want to do is keep the cats absolutely separate. One's in one room, you know, another's in another room. They can't see each other. They can hopefully not even hear each other. And then you alternate. So your resident cat gets to come out in the living room and hang out while the other cat is in the back bedroom. Gets gets his or her scent all over it. Of course, it's there already. And then goes back to the room, you know, what place that he doesn't mind being, pretty cozy, comfy in there. You've conditioned him to be comfy in that room. Then you let the new cat wander around, get his scent all over this living room area, smell the other cat, and then he goes back into the other room. Then you graduate, again, this is ideally, depending on your house, but then you graduate that you still have this middle neutral area. You have a cat in one room, a cat on the other side, on the east side, right? But you have a like a puppy gate in between. So they can see each other, but they can't actually get to each other. And then gradually you create situations where one cat can go into the neutral area and sniff the nose of the other cat. Maybe you're feeding them where they're sort of each 10 feet away from that gate. But most importantly, time. Don't push it. It might take 3 months. It might take six. Really might, but that's okay.
I can attest to 6 months.
Larry will tell you, but it's fine now, right, Larry?
It's fine now. Patricia McConnell will be with us right up until 12:30 today. We're going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we will be back. You stay with us. Larry Mueller here for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at your pet's behavior and how you might manage it, or how you might direct it, let's say. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Patricia McConnell, certified applied animal behaviorist, international speaker and author. She's got a great website and a great blog, and I just type her name in, you're going to find it on your site. Questions for her, I think our lines are pretty well filled right now. You could email us at ideas@wpr.org. But let's go to Mike in Dubuque, Iowa, right off the bat and see what's on Mike's mind. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
We have a 12-year-old husky. She's in good shape. She's not overweight. She's just a nice-tempered dog. But she has, for years, had an occasional issue with peeing inappropriately, and now it's become almost constant if she's not under watch all the time. There's no medical problem. She's had blood tests run, you name it. It's just, but if she's left alone...
Yeah.
She goes to the same rug.
Okay.
And she'll hit one corner and then the next corner and then the next corner if she needs to.
Okay.
Does she... And we're kind of at our wit's end.
Yeah, I don't blame you. It's, you know, it's it sounds trivial, but having an animal urinate in your home is not trivial
good.
At all. It's not okay. So you know, I'm not a veterinarian. What's the mystery? You know, there's a mystery here, right? Why is she doing this? And as good as veterinarians are, and, you know, I mean, I kiss the hem of their skirts and pants, right? They're not gods, and they can't always diagnose something. So it is possible it's some kind of a physical issue. But so let me ask you first, does she do this when you're home?
No, not if we're around.
Because that makes it sound more like... I'm sorry, what was that?
She might do it if you're out in the yard.
Okay. But if you're in the house with her, she doesn't do it. Which suggests it's not a medical... It's not urgency, right? You know, she doesn't have a UTI that nobody could find or something. It sounds more like separation anxiety, which is... not uncommon in older dogs as they get older and a little less strong. They start feeling a little frail. Maybe their hearing is going. 12 is a standard age for a lot of dogs' hearing to start decreasing a little bit. Maybe your eyes aren't as good. Do you think there's a possibility it could be her being anxious about being alone in the house?
It's possible. She's not alone. We have another dog.
Okay.
They're not particularly chummy, but they get along fine.
Well, That's interesting, because one of the things I've learned over the decades is, you know, and this happened to me. I had two females who...
I'm remembering that.
You remember Misty? Yeah, Misty and Lassie. So they weren't particularly chummy either, but they never fought. Every once in a while, Misty would give like a nasty look towards Lassie, and I'd say, Misty, I just see her eyes. It just got hard and nasty, and I like, Misty, cut it out. And she'd be like, oh, I wasn't doing anything. I'm fine. And then Misty died, and Lassie became a different dog, right? A totally different dog. It's like, ding dong, the witch is dead, witch is dead. It's just totally different. I've seen this over and over again. I saw it with two cats I had. I've seen it with tons of clients. So I'm not saying that's what it is. But it might be that your dog is anxious about being either with you not, you know, her humans are not in the house, or she's, you know, in the house with this other dog who's sort of also being a pain in the butt in some way. So you might want to try an experiment. Take the other, first of all, management. First of all, you've got to treat this area. You've got to make it stop smelling like a bathroom, because dogs use scent to tell them where the bathroom is. You know, we do not put our noses up in a restaurant and start sniffing the air and going like, you don't start smelling like, which way is the restroom? Right. We look, right? We're visual. Dogs use scent. And so she's going where it smells like urine. So you've got to treat that area, get rid of that rug. You know, if she's been doing it for a long time, even the commercial, Larry's
stuff
shaking his head.
Yeah.
It's like,
I changed rugs.
Yeah, Larry's shaking his head in despair. So if it's not too bad, sometimes the commercial urine deodorizers can work. If you've used soap or detergent on it, it's especially hard to get out. You might want to change the rug. So sort of check that out as much as you can. You might want to start feeding her in this area once it's cleaned up and does not smell like urine, even to a dog who can smell one molecule of cocaine in a warehouse of coffee, right? Or signs of bones that were there 3,000 years ago. I mean, their noses are astounding. So just because you can't smell urine doesn't mean your dog can. So pay a lot of attention to that, first of all. And the other thing I do is see what happens if you leave her alone with the other, you know, without the other dog there. Just experiment. You know, what is it? What causes this? And then think about, one, just do we need to treat separation anxiety, which, again, does happen not uncommonly with dogs as they get older. So that's a possibility. I have a booklet on separation anxiety called I'll Be Home Soon. So you might want to pick that up, or look, you know, there's some other books out there that could be really helpful. That's my best guess, that it's either separation anxiety or anxiety about being left with the other dog in the house. So that you need to mess with that and see if you can solve the mystery, and meanwhile manage it. You know, you might even want to confine her to a place, get her comfortable in a crate while you're gone, and see if that's going to help things too.
Yeah, good luck, Mike.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Carla in Fox Lake. Hi, Carla.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a mixed breed dog, 60 pounds, highly anxious. Henry is on 60 milligrams of Prozac every day, wears an e-collar. I use primarily the vibration. He's come a long way in changing behaviors. The last bit is that he, when he sees a delivery truck, postal truck, garbage truck, he then goes to the window and bites and rips the interior windowsill. Destructive. I've tried bitter apple, Vaseline, and he will just change over to some wooden furniture and bite on that.
And you have a problem with this? I don't know. Poor thing. Oh my goodness. My goodness, you poor thing. The 60-pound dog, can you imagine the jaw pressure that dog can put into a piece of wood? So first of all, so this is at baseline, this is an arousal issue, right? Your dog is getting so excited and so aroused that he just like has to do something. You know, and so he's deflecting all that energy. Like, I'm going to just chew something up. I have to do something. And, you know, what are dogs going to do? They don't write letters to the editor. So, you know, they just chew on something, right? So this is, we're circling back to where we started, Larry, about management and training, being hand in hand, your best partners. So first of all, I would manage it in that, if you know somebody's coming, right, if you're expecting somebody, which we don't always, so I'll make that caveat right away. But if you do happen to know people are coming, you know, he goes into a back room before the problem starts. The training issue, I would start with friends who pretend to be delivery people. Their car drives up in the driveway. You know, they pretend to be, you know, whatever delivery service you happen to have most commonly. They come up, they ring the doorbell. You have to figure out what first sets him off. Is it the car in the driveway? Is it somebody getting out of the car and shutting the door, you know? Is it coming to the door? Is it ringing the doorbell? Figure out what the main trigger is. And find the first one, not the one where he's lost it, right? Find the first trigger where he starts getting aroused and excited. And you think, he's excited now, but he's not so excited that he wouldn't eat a piece of steak, right? So start sort of working on that threshold and basically teaching him. I would do it with nobody there. So he goes to the window for no reason, right? You could maybe even lure him to the window, give him a reason to go to the window. And then I want you to call him away from the window with a piece of steak in your hand or whatever it is, and lure him away and put him into a back room. And I should ask you, do you have like a back room you could put him in away from those front windows?
No, unfortunately. He has a kennel, a crate that I can put him into.
Okay, and is he pretty happy in it? Is he comfortable in it?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I think so
you could use that. That's fine. So make that place, okay, nobody's coming to your house at all. And what you're going to do is make going into his crate the best thing ever. I love going to my crate because every time I go in there, I get a Kong stuffed with frozen meat, or I get, you know, a whole bunch of treats thrown over the bottom of the crate. And then I get let out right away, or I get to stay there and, you know, chew on something wonderful. So going in the crate is going to be even better than it was before. And then use it for management, but then start training him when he's not too excited or too aroused that when you say, let's go in your crate, just like I send my dogs when somebody comes to the door, you say, let's go in the crate. And I have to get out of the way because the dogs thunder past me and run into the study because they are probably going to get something wonderful, right? So start training it again when he's not so aroused that he can't listen. He doesn't even want to take food anymore. Once he's so excited that he's chewing on the windowsill, all you can do is put him on a leash and gently pull him away and just take him away and try and, you know, get him to calm down, pet him, soothe him, get him far away from the window, give him some treats, give him something else to do, for example, teach him some tricks, keep him busy. So, but you're going to work your way up to him being like, oh, I don't care that somebody pulled into the driveway. I'm going to go into my crate because I love it there.
There you go, Carla. Thank you so much for calling. And let's take another call. Jake in Peshtigo, we'll go to you next. Hi, Jake.
Yes, I have a dog that when I put him in the kennel and go to shut the door, he'll growl at me. And this started about, 3 months ago or so. Before that, he would enter his kennel and everything. Otherwise, he seems very cooperative and well-trained. If I'm leaving the house, he'll wait till I go through the doorway first. Same thing coming back in. He seems to want to do the right thing all the time. He looks at you. But when you want him to put him in the kennel and close the grate, he'll growl at you. And then once in a while too, where you're going to pet him, he kind of looks at you like, "Who are you?" Or you're bothering me, and he'll growl.
I don't do that. Gotcha.
Yeah.
We all know that look, right?
Yeah.
Don't do that. I wish I could do that better to people. You watch some of those movies with those amazing people who just give a look, you know, and like the whole room stops. It's like, that's so not me. So your dog is how old?
Almost two.
Oh, he's young. Okay. He's young. All right. So I was sort of thinking of older dogs because very often I've run into cases like that where the dog was older and didn't want to go to the crate because it was no longer comfortable. So we can toss that baby out the window, right? Although it's possible that he's also, he might be trying to tell you, I'm not comfortable in here. I don't want to go in here. So just as I was talking, I don't know if you heard me talk to the last caller, but I was advising her to make the crate him like the best place ever, right? This is a wonderful place to be. I love it to be in my crate. So look at the crate. Look at the size of the crate. Look how comfortable you think you would be. Go ahead and be anthropomorphic. Would I be comfortable if I was the size of my dog in the same shape? Would I be comfortable there? Because as he's gotten older, he might have gotten bigger. His shape has changed some. He might be trying to tell you, I don't like it in here anymore, you know? He also might be trying to tell you, I don't want you to pet me right now, right?
Sure.
Just, I don't want to be bothered right now. So it might be some about social control. You know, people use the word dominance. It's like the D word now. It's been so misunderstood. I don't like to use it. But there is this aspect of social control, like don't pet me. I don't want to be petted right now, right? So it might be some of that. And the fact that he's two means he's sort of coming into his own, you know, sort of getting little like I'm a grown up now. I'm not going to do what you say because I'm a grown up. So I would work on conditioning him, you know, basically it's fun to be in your crate. Make sure the crate's really, truly comfortable for him. Put him in and let him out. Like put him in, give him treats, let him out. Make going in and out sort of a fun game. Every time you shut the gate, give him a treat as you're doing that, you know, throw some treats on the ground. So while you're shutting it, he's eating treats on the floor of the crate. See if you can finesse your way through in kind of a conditioning way. If you're doing that and you're sure you're doing it right, I would talk to a trainer because I don't want this to escalate any further.
Yeah.
So I would get in contact with a trainer. They're so busy right now. You might actually want to make an appointment with one. We'll see you in 3 months. You know?
Yeah.
Just be sure they're a science-based trainer. They understand the use of positive reinforcement. They're not like, quote, dominance-based trainers. Don't want you to get into that fighting with your dog. But you might want to just make an appointment with somebody to come do a house call. But meanwhile, do what I suggested, and hopefully that'll take care of the problem.
Good luck, Jake. Thank you so much for calling. Tina emailed to ask what she should do to keep her dog and her new grandson safe and happy when together. So far, the dog's been doing well with the baby.
Oh, that's a wonderful question. So, yeah, the baby, you know, there's a baby and then there's a toddler, right? And usually the trouble comes in when the child starts being able to walk around and especially grab things, you know, those adorable little fists, you know?
Yeah.
They're so cute. You just basically flooded with oxytocin. But they love to grab dogs. They love to grab fur. They love to grab tails, you know, or they love to, you know, hugging is a very innate human behavior. It's a primate-wide thing. Primate, you know, lots of monkeys and apes hug. We hug. Little tiny baby kids hug. Dogs don't hug. It's really rude to them. So one of the keys is to, once the child starts toddling, first of all, make sure the dog knows the kid's name, your grandson's name. So, oh, look, there's Jack. Oh, look, there's Jack. And something wonderful comes, you know, after the word Jack. He looks at Jack and something good happens. But you're always going to protect the dog from Jack, right? That's what you in order to protect Jack from the dog, you need to protect the dog from Jack. That's, you know, it's the circular thing that's really important. And it starts with protecting the dog from Jack so he doesn't feel defensive. So the most important thing I can tell you to do is to learn the subtle signs of dogs who are stressed or de-stressed or anxious. There are a million videos online that people think are incredibly cute and funny of young children basically torturing dogs, and everybody's laughing, and every trainer and behaviorist is holding their breath and pulling their hair out of their head and waiting for the bite. Right?
Yeah.
That should have happened, except the dog was like Wonder Dog, right? So learn about dogs going stiff. Learn about a mouth being closed. Learn about Even a tail wag is not okay if the rest of the body is stiff and still and not moving. Learn what whale eye means. Learn. And that's basically when a dog turns its head away but turns the eyes in the other direction. So you can see a lot of white. So learn those signals. Every animal behaviorist, when we get together, we have a glass of wine and somebody asks, what is the most important thing you can do to prevent dog bites? It's that. It's learn to read dogs so you can prevent dogs from being put in situations in which they have to defend themselves. So good luck and yay for you for asking.
Yeah, and you cover that well in at least one of your books.
Yeah, and there's a video. I can't remember the name, but something about translation. There it is. It's translation something. How old am I, Larry? My brain is the color of my hair. It's getting very gray. Anyway, so there are a lot of resources out there. I have some, other people have some, and check them out about how to read signs of dogs' discomfort and just do everything you can to prevent them.
Tekla and Beaver Dam, what's on your mind?
I'm calling about a different kind of animal. I need help conditioning the behavior of the Homo sapiens in my home.
I'm sorry, they're too difficult to train.
Well, the problem is to get them to participate in expecting certain behaviors from, we have three dogs. One of them is a puppy that was gifted to us a year ago. And I've trained them to be fed in a certain way where they wait until the food's there or that they don't go running out of the door and that they don't jump up on me. But the other adults, we don't have children in the house, but the other adults in the house, what do I do?
We're all, Larry and I are like nodding sympathetically, the hardest species in the world to train. But hey, I have a great idea for you. It's a book a friend and colleague wrote, Dr. Karen London wrote a book called Treat Everyone Like a Dog. And it's exactly what you need. It's about changing the behavior of the humans around you. And also yourself, using good, solid principles of learning and behavior, and influencing behavior. So using the things that I use, that my colleagues use to change the behavior of the dogs we live with, to change the behavior of the humans around us. And each chapter is a different sort of kind of particular point, particular principle. And she gives example after example. She raised two boys. She had to use a lot of this, and she has two of the most wonderful boys you've ever met, men now, young men. So get Treat Everyone Like a Dog. It's on Amazon by Dr. Karen London. Read it as soon as it comes. It's hysterically funny. It's brilliantly done, and I guarantee you it will help.
Tekla, thank you so much for calling. And Patricia, thank you so much. Oh, this has been so much fun. You'll come back and be with us again.
I hope. I don't know. Of course, I love seeing you, Larry. I've missed you. It's so fun to see you in person. I would love to be back.
We will have her back. Patricia McConnell, Certified Applied Animal Behaviorist. Just type in Patricia McConnell into your website, into your search engine, and you're going to pop up with her. With her website and with you'll find her blog as well. Her blog is really great too. And she'll be back and we'll do it again. Tomorrow we'll talk about homesteading and the Soil Sisters event that's coming up. And we'll also look at some new land conservation law program. That's tomorrow. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mealer.